Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
Hello, I'm Adam.
And I'm Joe. We're the Vox Duo, and we're here to talk about what a great time this is to be alive and to be entertained. And as proof of that, what more could you ask for than the fact that we've got the Black Panther movie in the theaters right now? It's a big-budget comic book movie, which 15 years ago wouldn't have even been a thing that we would have thought we would get. But not only that, it's got an almost entirely Black cast and a Black director, and tackles issues like power dynamics between Africans and the colonizers from the rest of the world, which is also not something you would expect to get in a big budget Hollywood production. So this is, you know, as far as living in a golden age, I feel like the Black Panther is kind of as emblematic a movie as you could possibly ask for. But the real question, at least from our perspective, is the Black Panther actually any good? Adam?
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Yes. Yes, I was. Thank God. much like the Wonder Woman movie, there was a lot riding on this one. Because for aforementioned cultural reasons, I think we all wanted it to be good. People filled with white resentment may not like that, but those of us cheering on, representation of our fellow Americans would be quite happy with that. And the nice thing is that the Black Panther is very good. In fact, I'd put it up there as one of the strongest solo introductions in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and definitely maybe my sixth or seventh favorite.
That's quite a bit of praise right there. I'm going to, and we talked about this a little bit over text message after I came out of the movie, I'm going to pour just a little bit of cold water on this, in that I feel it was a good movie. I give it an enthusiastic thumbs up, but I don't love it. And I'm not entirely sure why. I can say I just, thinking back over it the past 3 or 4 days since I've seen it, it's still good. I don't have any massive big complaints about it. But at the same time, I just don't feel all that passionate about it one way or another. And I'm not quite sure why. And I'm interested in talking through the movie with you to see if I can pinpoint what it is that's left me a little bit apathetic.
Well, I'm gonna ding it for, I think, perhaps talking about it in relation to the movies that I would put ahead of it might shed some light on the subject for you, depending on if you agree with what I'm going to say. The Marvel movies that still hold the most respect in my heart are the ones which are character-based. The ones in which by the end, you know, we've fallen in love essentially with the main characters. I think you get that with Tony Stark in the first Iron Man movie. I think you get that with Steve Rogers in the first Captain America movie, even though both of them have much weaker third acts and villains than Black Panther does. And on the whole, we forgive them for that, I think, because we like those people. And T'Challa himself is a bit of a bore. I'm not in love with these characters. I like their adventure. I enjoy spending time with them, but I'm not shipping T'Challa and Nakia.
Yeah, I think that's probably definitely part of it for me as well. Captain America and the original Iron Man movie, both, you know, if I think back over the entire Marvel collection of movies that we have now, those are two of the ones that most readily come to mind as just being a boatload of fun. And as you say, we care about the characters by the time the movie is over. They've grabbed us and held on. And there's a lot of other movies that are good that just don't necessarily pop up to the top of mind when I'm thinking about Marvel. And I do want to say here, I think this is more, I think there's going to be a very polarized reaction to this, because based on reactions I've seen on Twitter and elsewhere, if you're black, this is a movie that has a huge impact on you. And I can definitely understand why. It deals with black people and the black community as something worthy of respect, as something with a complicated past in history where they've been steamrolled by whites way, way, way too often. And here's a movie that shows them wrestling with the decision of whether or not to strike back, whether or not to fight back, and how they should react to having more power than anyone else around them. And that's something that just by virtue of being white and having grown up in majority white communities, I can't emotionally connect with. And so I'm open to the idea that part of the problem with the movie isn't the movie, that it's me. That it just doesn't grab me the way Captain America and Tony Stark did, because I'm not 100% the target audience.
Well, since we're delving into the major themes here, you know, I detected that whole Malcolm X versus, you know, maybe Martin Luther King dynamic. I think that's the easy comparison to make there. Or X-Men, if you prefer, Magneto and Professor X, the other go-to comic book version. Although it didn't seem, I don't know, I liked that because questions of revolution and revolution itself, the very concept in many ways, is a romantic concept for me. The siren call of it, the American Revolution, if you would, and discussing how one resists forces. But that wasn't even dominant for me. I feel like there was plenty to tuck into regardless of whether this was directly aimed at you. I think it's really cool how it works on either level. If you're black, you've got that to delve into, sure. But Wakanda's position mirrors America's in no small way. He mentions specifically, T'Challa specifically refers to refugees at one point, and that's not an accident. Wakanda is the superpower on a continent of third world countries, and a nation's responsibility to other people around the world when it's doing well is, I think, a Western question in general.
Yeah, and I did pick up on that in the movie, definitely the refugee question of whether we let them in or whether we go outside of our borders and help the people where they are, which is certainly a question worth pondering today about, as you say, about more than just Wakanda. It was dealing with a lot of broader themes, and maybe that's part of the reason why I feel like I should like it more than I actually do. So I guess let's go through the movie and kind of talk through what happened in the movie and see if maybe that can illuminate where it is that I'm less satisfied with it, and where it is that you think it does rate above a large number of other Marvel movies.
Sure. And the last thing I'll say about themes before we do is that I will cop to the fact that you can get a long way with me. I give a lot of credit for a good theme, well discussed. People who don't like these themes often say that you're putting politics into it or what have you. But for me, when you're telling a story needs to be about something. I think that's what gives the meaning. I seem to have been among, you know, the hardcore geeks, one of these relatively few people who just came out of Star Trek Into the Darkness, feeling really happy because they were obviously talking about drone warfare. So I do tend to maybe lose my perspective a little bit when I'm happy that a movie is being brave. But yeah, let's jump into it, starting from the exposition in the beginning.
Yeah, we jump right into a voiceover narration of one character asking another for the history of Wakanda, essentially. And we talk about the fact that a meteorite struck Africa, carrying the rarest metal there is, vibranium, and totally altering the Wakanda ecology, not just putting vibranium in the ground to be mined, but altering the plants themselves, which in turn alters the people and gives the leader of the tribe, who is both a political leader as well as a spiritual leader, gives him superhuman strength and reaction time, the Black Panther.
Yes, and this is a pretty good time, I think, to just talk about Wakanda in general and the whole grand concept of Black Panther. One thing that this movie has firmly in its corner for me is just this sense of discovery again. For me, and you know, you can call it sad if you want, but let's dwell on the positive right now. Just this idea of this futuristic, secret African nation that's way ahead of everyone else. You know, this is this really fun new sci-fi concept. I've felt more delighted watching Wakanda be unveiled than I often do seeing new worlds in science fiction movies appear. You know, for me, it has that really fun, wow, look at this feel to it. And it's worth noting that this is how it was introduced in Fantastic Four, you know, the whole shtick of Fantastic Four, because they were halfway between the science heroes of the first half of the 20th century and the superheroes that we're familiar with now, was to go to these crazy new worlds and explore them and these secret jungle lairs and all this other very pulpy stuff. And so this was this fun, crazy new idea that there was this secret African nation where, thank you very much, but Black people have figured all this stuff out a long time ago.
Yeah, you're right. There's definitely something wonderful about one of the opening scenes that we get. I mean, not just the voiceover narration and the visuals that were there, but when T'Challa is actually flying into Wakanda for the first time, or at least the first time we see him flying into Wakanda, and swooping over the landscapes in this very futuristic-looking ship, swooping over people who seem to be very traditional third world Africans, goat farmers and basic, you know, tilling the land and everything looking fairly primitive. And all of a sudden they fly through a force field and they're over a very modern, very advanced city that they're hiding almost in plain sight. And you're right, that was very reminiscent of a lot of the visuals you get when various characters are visiting other planets and being amazed at the technology there. And so we very early get an indication that the Wakandans are something special and they don't feel they need to flaunt it.
And it results in this fresh new aesthetic, too. You know, the hard thing if you are writing a science fiction story is to come up with something that feels new. And this African aesthetic as applied to this optimistic future does the trick for me. You know, the attention getter is always that silent elder who has the lip plate.
Yes.
But a lot of touches like that. I just really felt like everything looked different. I was interested in this new world and was always glad to be there as opposed to anywhere else. Although, you know, the only other place we did go was Korea, so this really was my movie.
Yeah, it was really, the locations were fairly limited, which makes sense for a Black Panther origin story. It's as much a story of his nation and of his culture as it is a story of him. So it makes sense that we stay close to where he's from.
Well, so as far as the whole mythological start to the film, I was perfectly pleased with it. I thought that was a fine way to go. You didn't need to introduce everything slickly while the story was in play. I felt like, you know, the whole thing was just opening up that we were going to get an epic, and I was cool with that.
Yeah, agreed. It helped to set the stage right away from the very beginning and save a lot of what could have been painful exposition later in the movie. So we start with that voiceover narration, but we don't actually see Wakanda right away. We actually start the movie in Oakland in, I believe, the mid 80s with some people who at initial look look like gangbangers. They've got guns on the table. They've got what looks like plans for some kind of a heist or takeover, robbery, attack, something. Some kids outside playing basketball. And then we meet the first, well, not the first Black Panther, but we meet T'Challa's father, T'Chaka, who is the Black Panther. And it turns out he's confronting his brother, Prince N'Jobu, of Wakanda. And we learn here that there has been a theft of vibranium. There's been an explosion at the Wakandan border. A lot of Wakandans are dead. And it's Ulysses Klaue that was hired to carry out this theft.
Yes, and I like how tightly plotted this all is. But I'm just going to offer two notes here as far as this scene. First of all, I love how they don't reveal their hand. For me, having not seen any spoilers at all, having not read anything about the plot, I was unaware that we were going to get the movie's main villain. And when you start, you know, the kid's playing basketball, and he's not shot in such a way that there's an arrow pointing to him. You don't realize that this kid is going to matter later in the story. And I appreciate that, how we double back and we didn't realize what we were seeing at the time. We think the story is beginning with the theft of vibranium when it's really beginning with the death of Eric's father.
Right. And I agree. I love the way the camera work just shows a group of kids playing basketball and a group of kids looking up at the sky and wondering what's going on. And you're almost given to think these are just neighborhood kids out there who are playing. They've got no relation to the rest of the movie except to illustrate that this is a typical neighborhood where people live and work and play.
Absolutely. And the second note that I would make, and I have no, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I really feel like this was as strong a start to the actual story as you could get, both thematically and story-wise, because first of all, we're setting events in motion, of course. We're getting background going. But also, opening up with gangbangers sets a tone that we've seen many times before, the Black inner city. And wonder and any emotion has to proceed from a baseline. If you're going to scare me, you have to set things up lower than that first, and so forth. And so before showing us this African utopia, reminding us of where or how Black people are usually presented was important. So I thought that that was really smart, that we start in the same place you've seen Black people in a ton of movies. And then from there, we get into this much more hopeful, optimistic wonderland of a story.
Right. We pick up T'Challa, who is on his way home from Captain America Civil War, where he's been attempting to capture the murderer of his father, T'Chaka. And he is flying home with Okoye, the leader of the Dora Milaje, to figure out what to do next exactly. But before we can get to Wakanda, we have to make a stopover in, I believe, what was mentioned as Nigeria to, well, we're not quite sure at the beginning, but he puts on the Black Panther suit and he jumps out of the plane, and we get some wonderful visuals of what looks like garden variety third world thugs going through a jungle, and then the panther crouched in a tree ready for the attack, which the panther Black Panther crouched in a tree was one of my favorite visuals from the entire movie.
There are a number of good visuals in this movie, and they're always nice to see. Let's talk about direction here just for a minute. You know, there's a lot more that goes into it than just those arresting visuals by good cinematographers. And some people feel that if you aren't noticing the direction at all, then the director is really doing his job because you're absorbed in the story. And I think that's perfectly valid. But Marvel movies remind me of Marvel comics in the 80s, in that they are very firmly set in a house style. And so there's not a lot of visual variation. So whenever I catch a really beautiful shot in this movie, and there were several, I was happy to see it. I don't feel like it's common. I feel like in almost every Marvel movie you see, if you're impressed by something, if you say, whoa, it's because of what's on the screen, never how it's shot.
Yeah, I think that's by and large mostly true. It is the odd Marvel moment that makes you marvel at what's on the screen rather than marvel at what's happening on the screen.
Yeah, directors just aren't encouraged in the Marvel universe to put their particular visual stamp on a property. They want it all to feel like one universe, and that's fair enough. Obviously, it's working well for them.
Yeah. So we get in this scene where this ties into the story is Black Panther T'Challa is extracting who we later learn is his girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, Nakia, from an undercover assignment that she's on, essentially pulling her out in the middle of the assignment. She complains that she's not done with what she's doing yet, and he says, well, he's on his way home to officially become the king, and he wants her there when he goes through that ceremony. And I don't know that I have much more to say about that other than the fact that it's a close relationship when you can stop and pick up your ex-girlfriend from the middle of an undercover assignment that she's doing and have her not complain all that much about the fact that you've done it.
Yeah, you could quibble with his priorities. Hey, I want you in the crowd. I'm about to be king. Never mind the drug-busting mission you were on. I'm willing to bet that this being a ritual ceremony, you know, that maybe he puts great importance on it for some reason. Anyway, it's a beat scene. It's like when Spider-Man stops muggers. We needed at some point to get a quick idea of what exactly it is the Black Panther can do. And that's what this serves, as well as establishes relationship with Nakia and so forth.
Well, and it establishes him as a little more of a human character. I will admit one of my concerns going into this movie. I like Chadwick Boseman, but he plays quiet, intense characters, and we really hadn't seen much of T'Challa in Captain America: Civil War. He was in the costume most of the time, and I was a little bit worried that we would get a broody, quiet character who didn't have much personality. And I think this scene served to establish right off the bat that no, he does have a little bit of a personality. He's warned not to freeze up when he sees Nakia, and he says that he won't, and then he immediately freezes up, as I think a lot of guys would when running into your ex-girlfriend.
Or when just running into Lupita Nyong'o? Is this how we say her name? Absolutely. You bring up a good point, actually, as far as the Black Panther's characterization here, because at least in the take that repopularized him, he was aloof. He didn't really even have that relationship going with Nakia. He had Okoye and Nakia as sort of brides in waiting, and he was not going to marry either of them because essentially the possibility that he would marry one of them was what kept their tribes in line. And he played a role that was almost, in a sense, fatherly to them. And the whole idea of T'Challa was very kind of Batman as ruler of an African nation, in that, he would often take a beating. He'd have his sacrifices and whatnot, but he was usually playing fifth-dimensional chess with people who only knew the original board game.
Right, and I picked up a little of that. I was diving into some of the comics myself before the movie, and I did pick up a little of that quiet, enigmatic figure who exists almost as a symbol of fear to Wakanda's enemies, but you don't really get to know the man behind the mask. And I think that can work in the comics, but I think for a movie, especially a movie with him as the main character, you need to have more than that. And so I was happy in the theater to see, okay, we are going to get something from Chadwick Boseman that you can hang your hat on for the next 2.5 hours.
I wasn't displeased, but I'm not willing to go so far as to say it was a creative decision. I think it's part of the Marvel formula, and so that's what they were going to do.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree there. So they pick up Nakia, and they finish flying to Wakanda, which is where we get the scene of them swooping over the farmers and the landscape, and then suddenly passing through the shield and arriving over the city. And the plane lands, T'Challa gets off, and that's when we meet his mother, Ramonda, the Queen Mother, and his sister, Shuri. And I've got to say, I absolutely love the interaction between T'Challa and Shuri in this scene. I just thought it was super fantastic from the beginning straight through to when she gives him the finger while walking away, and her mother knows that she's giving him the finger without ever even looking back. The whole scene was just delightful.
Yeah, I do like Shuri. She's sassy in a way that is endearing rather than irritating, and that can definitely go either direction when you're dealing with that sort of character. Moving on from that, and you know, this whole section I would say is kind of just setting out the rules. You know, he meets his mother, he meets his sister, and then of course he becomes the king of Wakanda, and we see him go through these various steps: the ritual combat, the eating of the herb that gives him his powers, the sacred burial that allows him to speak to his ancestors, in which we get one of those arresting visuals I mentioned earlier in the afterlife. And just what I want to say about all of this is that it's just so appreciably tight. This is another point of why I like the movie so much. It reminds me very much of The Matrix, and that you get through so much of the movie without realizing that you're still in the exposition stage, that they're explaining stuff to you so that they can call back to it later. So often exposition feels like exposition, and that wasn't the case here for me.
Yeah, this whole sequence, this whole setup, introduction to Wakanda and to the king was very interesting. I did very much like the scene with T'Challa talking to T'Chaka and admitting that he doesn't feel ready to be the king. A lot of that felt real to me. And also you get, during the ritual combat scene, you get one of the first signs that the movie is really fully 100% going to embrace the Africanness of its main character and its main society, in that the whole setup of the people gathered around and watching is very traditional African. It was clearly done by people who knew what a realistic society and culture should look like, and were going to bring it to screen, rather than people who were just faking it or doing a halfway job. And that was impressive to me.
Yeah, I'm sure that they did their homework for this film, much like Coco or whatever the recent movie was, and Disney movie about the Pacific Islanders. They knew that they were at risk of touching nerves here. And the nice thing about that, that they had to walk on eggshells, is that you know that the results are pretty well thought out.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't just something that was drawn up over an afternoon on the back of a napkin.
Right. And again, it's just tight. Here we get introduced to M'Baku, who is one of the villains of the Black Panther series. It's for me, having read the comics, it was just like, oh, they got M'Baku in here. And of course, once again, I think to myself, well, that's cool. They'll fight and T'Challa will win and he'll be the new king and that'll be it. Not realizing that once again, they're setting up the rest of the story.
Yeah, I will say that this fight here was maybe one of my first moments of disappointment with the movie. It's obvious that T'Challa is going to become king, that he's going to win this fight. And maybe because of that reason, maybe because of the overall choreography, the fight itself just seemed a little bit boring to me. I knew what was coming. I knew he wasn't going to just win quickly and easily. I knew there would come a moment when he would lose the spear and The Shield. I knew there would come moments when he looked like he was very close to losing, and then, of course, he would draw deep on his reserves and ultimately emerge victorious. And so the fight just didn't interest me. That was one of the few parts of the early segment of the movie that felt like it could have been better.
My wife had the same reaction. I didn't mind so much, maybe because I was taken with the overall ceremony that you mentioned liking before. Or maybe having recognized these tropes, have granted their use. What did you think, if we can just skip ahead real quick, what did you think of the second fight? Did you feel the same way because you kind of saw it coming?
I did. It seemed pretty obvious that if you're going to bring King Killer in and... I feel like that's the wrong name. Killmonger. If you're going to bring Killmonger in and you're going to have a confrontation between the two of them, well, then obviously at this point in the movie, Killmonger is going to win and there's going to be some kind of crisis with the kingship. And so that was another fight that just felt like the outcome was preordained. And of course it is, because it's the script and it's the beat of the movie that he has to lose at this point. But I don't know, the whole choreography felt very, very standard, where I felt like I could predict exactly what was coming in the fight. Not just that he was going to lose, but how he was going to lose and what was going to happen. So it was another moment where there just wasn't any tension, and I just didn't find it that enjoyable.
You know, that's interesting. For me, it wasn't the first two fights of the three that were disappointing. It was the third one, really, because for me, it's really about rules. What was scary about Killmonger in the comics, what certainly surprised me, and what I thought they did well in this film, is that Killmonger is like Bane for Batman or Doomsday for Superman. In a fair fight, Killmonger wins, which establishes that character as particularly dangerous, because and it's rare, because usually the superhero, you know, through ingenuity or whatever, triumphs, or through his heart or whatever. And in the third fight, there's no particular reason that T'Challa manages to win, other than he pulls off a cool move. I would have liked to have seen some reason why the rule that they'd established, which is that Killmonger is a better fighter by far than T'Challa, is broken in that third fight. For example, it has to be kind of disorienting to suddenly have super strength, because you're not necessarily sure how much power to throw in your punches or something like that. Maybe he's a little off balance, ironically, as a result of having eaten the herb. Something like that would have been appreciated by me. It's a small issue that a whole lot of people won't care about. But as far as the first two fights go, I didn't mind. I thought they were fine.
Yeah, I didn't dislike them. I just felt cool to them. They didn't really do anything to increase my enjoyment of the movie. But we can move on from the fights. T'Challa, of course, does win the first fight, is crowned king, goes through all the rituals associated with the kingship, and then is faced with one of his first real decisions, as we find out that Ulysses' claw has reemerged, has a vibranium artifact that he is going to be selling to a bidder in Korea. And there comes the question of whether or not they go after Claw, and if they go after him, how they go after him. And we've got T'Challa interacting with his friend Wakabi, who was directly impacted by Claw and has a strong motive for revenge, which sets up our entire sequence in Korea.
Yes, 부산시도나십니까? I enjoyed that for personal reasons. Let me just note real quick that Claw is another example of the economy of this story. One of the unfortunate things about Black Panther is that he has a fairly weak rogues gallery, and just by happenstance, because he was just intended to be a bit player in Fantastic Four, I think, Claw, of all people, is his main villain. and not this kind of raging, drunk neo-colonist from the movies who is decently adapted so that, you know, he has some relevance to Black Panther thematically, but this villain made entirely of sound who is just sort of an odd fit. So I love that they managed to pay tribute to history but got him out of the way halfway through the movie. And it's impressive to me that they managed to include all three of the villains I would name if you asked me to name Black Panther villains just in the first movie. I'm kind of curious where they go with the next one.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my comments as well, as we introduce Claw, and at least from the comics I've read and the Black Panther stuff I've seen, and the Marvel stuff in general I've seen animated on TV, Claw has always seemed like a fairly major player, and then we kill him off halfway through the movie, which did leave me wondering, well, it almost seems to me that Marvel has a little bit of a tendency to introduce villains and then rather finally remove villains in a way that it doesn't look like they're coming back unless we do some kind of mass resurrection. I do wonder a little bit if this goes on, how many Marvel villains we're going to be left with.
Yeah, I mean, in Claw's case, you could get away with bringing him back as a pure energy being like he is in the comics or something, but the fact of the matter is that it's no great loss. The nice thing about Marvel movies is that they get to cherry-pick from, you know, decades of continuity, and so they can quickly dispatch with the stuff that is, for whatever reason, an important part of the character's history, but which also just isn't compelling except for hardcore fans. And Clough falls firmly under that category. You know, it's like the mercenary at the very beginning of Captain America 2, Batroc, as if, you know, if he were the main villain of Cap instead of the Red Skull and the Winter Soldier or something, then you'd still just want to have that fight and get rid of him.
Yeah, I think I can see that. I will say, regarding the fact that the deal is going down in Busan, in Korea, and maybe it's because I know too much, and I know how much movie studios want to appeal to the Asian market these days, but it definitely felt like the only reason everything was going down in Korea was so that everything could go down in Korea, and we could have a scene in Korea. A little bit of pandering to the home crowd in some sense. And I don't really have a problem with that per se. And maybe the world of international intrigue really is globalized to the extent that a lot of deals go down in Korea. But it just felt like a little bit of a random choice.
I actually felt the same way, despite my love of that country. The only real reason for it being in Korea was undoubtedly due to some deal that Korea made with a studio. And you know what? Fair enough, I guess, because if you think about it, a lot of locations in James Bond are essentially random, too, and really, isn't Korea still more fresh than Rome or Paris? But I did feel the same way.
So we go to Korea, and we go to this underground casino, and I'll just say that one of my favorite parts of the entire movie was everything that goes down in the casino and in the car chase afterwards. I thought that was tremendously entertaining. I loved watching all of the main characters at work. I loved watching them interacting with each other. And I thought Andy Serkis did an absolutely bang-up job as Claw and really looked like he was having a lot of fun in the role. So I think this was one of the highlights of the movie.
My favorite part of the whole scene, I think, was watching Okoye kick butt. That character really endears herself to the audience in the film by being so awesome, but also, you know, having this sort of sly humor to her. There's a point in the car chase where you're pretty she has the car blown out from under her, and she kind of flies limply in the air, and you could hear and just kind of feel the audience gasp in sadness at the idea that she was about to die, which is, you know, often something that films can't accomplish with a real death scene, never mind a fake out.
Yeah, this was the whole sequence where I really fell in love with her as a character, partly because she most of the time plays everything so straight. The perfect general, the leader of the Dora Milaje, who is the bodyguard to the king and who takes her job very seriously. But you get the subtle moments where she's very annoyed at having to wear a wig to blend in as they go into the casino. And she absolutely hates wearing the wig, which was an interesting moment for me because that was the first time I realized that I had gotten so used to the Dora Milaje having shaved heads that it, as she walked into the casino, it actually, to me, looked wrong that she was wearing a wig. Like, that's not the way that's supposed to be. That is clearly some kind of, not disguise, but it's a diversion from the way she's supposed to look. Which, given how unnatural it is to see women without hair, I was impressed at how deftly the movie had gotten me comfortable with seeing her without hair, that seeing her with hair suddenly became the weird moment.
Okay, since you mentioned the hair, am I overanalyzing now? Or in a movie that is so concerned with blackness and black culture, is it not significant, but not accidental that we get a black woman wearing a wig at one point? Because wigs, I think, are a part of black culture in a way that they aren't in most others in the U.S.
This is where I'm going to plead total ignorance. I know that hair is a big thing in black culture and how hair is styled is a big thing. Whether or not wigs have specific significance, it's just totally outside my area of knowledge. The only thought I had in regards to this scene and to the general look of the Dora Milaje was, again, since I had time to read about 8 issues of the comics before watching the movie, I knew that in the comics, at least the ones I was reading, they don't have hair. So in that sense, to me, the movie was just going along with the established nature of the characters rather than doing anything particularly noteworthy.
Yeah, I don't know if they have significance in the sense that they're symbolic of things or what have you. I just mean that, you know, it's much more common. Anyway, all right, and let's take note of a very important character's introduction. Not so important in the movie, which is one of the interesting things about him, but definitely part of the lore. Everett K. Ross, played by Martin Freeman. I'm very curious because I think, since I know what comics you've read, you actually haven't really read any comics about Everett K. Ross. So what do you think of the character?
Yeah, that was where I suddenly realized that perhaps I should have read the Christopher Priest run, or at least a couple of issues of it, before going into the theater. Everett K. Ross is one of my biggest complaints regarding the movie. I have no problem with the character as introduced in the casino. I have little problem with him. He starts out almost a little bit antagonistic. I'm going to get the vibranium artifact, and I just want you, T'Challa, to stay out of my way. And then during the car chase, he more or less, once everything blows up with Claw, more or less switches to wanting to help T'Challa out, which, okay, fine, let's at least make sure whatever we do that Claw doesn't escape and we can be on the same side as regards to that. And then he gets the injury and they decide to take him to Wakanda to heal him. And that's the part where I begin to have major problems with the character and how the story is written.
I'd like to hear more about this before I throw in my sense. Okay, so what are the problems with how the story's written vis-a-vis Ross here?
So the issue is they make a big deal out of saying that he's American, CIA, he's a spy, he has a duty to report everything he sees back to the Americans. He's going to look out for his country's own best interests, which makes 100% sense to me. Absolutely. He's a spy. That is absolutely what he would do. And he wakes up in Shuri's lab after she's completely healed his injury. And he gets up, and there's all this wonderful tech immediately visible to him. He's not in any kind of an isolation room whatsoever, although you wouldn't think that would be that hard to rig up. And he's wandering around, marveling at all of the technology, and Shuri is very energetically explaining to him the answers to every question he asks. And maybe that's just her personality. Maybe it's her personality that she has no sense of operational security whatsoever. But you'd think, being the sister of the king and the daughter of the previous king, she would. And then we get into some fighting stuff later, and all of a sudden Everett K. Ross is 100% on the Wakandan side, helping them out. And I at least very much got the impression that had it came down to it, he would have kept their secret, which seemed to directly contradict what we'd been expecting earlier in the movie, without, to my mind, a lot of good explanation as to why.
Yes, I think you've got it nailed there. It feels like at least a story thread that just kind of goes nowhere. I mean, there are two ways that you can go with that story. One is that Black Panther has done the right thing by saving his life, and he's cost the kingdom. It's, it's and anonymity. And the second, of course, is that you have the people of Wakanda or this situation so endear themselves to Ross that he shuts up about it. And you can even cheat with that ending in that Ross can tell T'Challa, listen, I promise I'm not going to say anything. And T'Challa can give him a pat on the shoulder and said, don't worry about it. And then they walk out to the press conference and he announces, I'm Iron Man.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like there was a turn there that should have been there and was rather blatantly, conspicuously missing. And not a huge thing, and I don't think it would have taken too much to fix, but it annoys me that it wasn't fixed and it was just left dangling out there. It feels like somebody either wasn't paying attention or didn't feel that that was important enough to deal with.
Yeah, this is one of the points where I do have to ding the movie. You're 100% on target with that. That said, I do like this iteration of Everett K. Ross. Now, let me go ahead and give you the quick down low here on the comic book character. He is an inversion, I would say, of the black comedic relief in an action movie, which makes perfect sense. You know, the comic book was about these uber kick butt, super competent black characters. And so you had, first of all, Everett being an entry point for the reader, providing an outsider's perspective so that people could explain things to him. And you also had him being the silly, helpless guy, and also the CIA agent as a bonus. And he's sort of the American contact for Wakanda. And here they tone things down a bit, and essentially I'd say they give him a Watson from the BBC Sherlock Holmes series level of, not Sherlock Holmes, Sherlock, from the Sherlock BBC series level of competence, which is that he's a very capable CIA officer. He's just outclassed. And I think that's a perfectly fair way to go with the character. And liking that character, I'm perfectly happy to see him transplanted to the Marvel U. But yeah, his arc here doesn't work.
And I would say his personality in the movie is a little bit lacking. I love what you said about making him a Watson from Sherlock character, because that is the way his personality as a whole felt to me. He's the sidekick who fades into the background, and he didn't really seem to have much distinctive about him in the way of personality.
Was there perhaps, you know, he has a moment of not sacrifice, but a willingness to sacrifice. You know, that Watson's big moment is when he essentially decides to keep going after the last Wakandan vessel, even though he's probably going to die as a result. And you get the sense maybe that there was supposed to be something in there about him deciding to sacrifice himself for another country? I don't know. It was confused.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that I have a huge amount more to say about Ross. I think I've covered it. So I'm going to back up a little bit to a scene that we skipped over, which is where Shuri is taking T'Challa around her lab and showing him the upgrades that she's been working on for his technology. And this wasn't a bad scene. It was another one where I really enjoyed the interaction between Shuri and T'Challa, especially to the degree to where she has him hit the suit such that the suit sends him flying across the room, and she's taking a video for the purposes of uploading it to Wakandan YouTube, which is a very brother-sister interaction to have, and it was delightful. My problem with that scene is it was all very James Bond and Q, and I didn't feel that it needed to be James Bond and Q. I don't know, you know, I'm not enough of a writer to necessarily say how it should have been done instead. It just felt very much like Q walking James Bond around the lab and showing him the latest gadgets, and I didn't like it in this movie.
That's funny. This is, again, just like the fight scene. As a writer, I don't see the point of this scene to be to do something different, but just to do the same thing well. It's like the Olympics. You watch Chloe Kim do a triple axle. You don't sit down to expect her to do something new. You just want her to do the thing really well. And this was a perfectly fine iteration of that for me. I like the brother-sister dynamic. I think it has a little bit of extra bite to it because he's T'Challa, and in theory he should be the king and highly respected, and there's only one person who can probably take the piss out of him in the whole kingdom. The threat to put it up on YouTube, I imagine, was just that, a joke, because, you know, she wouldn't do that to him. So, I don't know, I had fun.
Yeah, and maybe it's that James Bond is such a white man's movie, such a, to use some of the language of the film, such a colonizer's movie, that it felt a little bit out of place in this particular movie. And granted, this scene is largely exposition so that you understand how his suit works and what capabilities it has so that you can use that later in the movie. So it wasn't horrible. I didn't care for it, and if I'm going to list some of the reasons why this movie isn't way high up on my list, that would be one of them.
Okay, fair enough. Well, with your permission, I will keep the party going. According to the Wikipedia summary, while in CIA custody, Claw is rescued by Eric Stevens, an ex-US Black Ops soldier. And again, my decision not to watch any film previews pays dividends, because honestly, I did not have Eric pegged as an important character before this scene. It was a nice little surprise that he was more than a henchman. And and then of course there's this later moment when he kills Claw, which is a surprise, because I, knowing especially his mythology in the comics, I expected him to live. And brings his body to Wakanda, which establishes him as a big bad because, of course, he has done something that Black Panther cannot. And so, this twist in the arc all worked for me.
Yeah, I agree. This really worked for me. I very much enjoyed Eric's robbery at the beginning of the movie when he steals the vibranium artifact from the museum. And with you, I got the sense that he was either a freelancer working with Claw or someone working directly for Claw, helping to pull off the robbery, which made the which fit right into the rescue of Claw when Claw was being held by the Wakandans. And then all of a sudden, Eric pulls up and blows in the back wall and they grab him and pull him out. Felt very much like, yeah, he's working for Claw. They've pulled off a rescue. And at this point, I expected the movie to go into some kind of a direction where there was going to be some more confrontations between Claw and T'Challa, and that the movie was going to revolve around capturing Claw. And then they wrong-foot you by having Eric pretty quickly thereafter kill Claw, which is, okay, now what's going on? But as you say, has emotional resonance, because he brings Claw to the Wakandans. And there had been a whole earlier scene where Wakabi is confronting T'Challa about, can you be king enough to capture this man who killed my family and bring him to justice? And T'Challa has promised that he will, and ultimately fails to carry through on that promise. And then here comes Eric showing up with the dead body instead, which is just a really powerful way of underlining exactly how capable Eric is, and showing why Wakabi might be willing to turn against T'Challa.
Exactly. And I'd like to take a moment here to say that I think here's another reason why this movie ranks pretty high on my Marvel Cinematic Universe list. I think he's one of the rare good villains of the MCU. It's a short list, as has been well established over the years. You know, you've got Loki at the top, of course. I'd say you have the Vulture in the new Spider-Man movie is a good character. You can kind of give Thanos some front credit and the Winter Soldier, depending on how you classify him. But Marvel villains are famously pretty boring in general, and I thought they did a really good job with Killmonger. One characteristic of his that I think really adds to him is the fact that he grew up in Oakland, and much like one character talking like a normal person in Asgard kind of makes that way of speaking fresh again, because it's so different from everyone else's. The fact that he speaks like a gangsta from the inner city is unique now and appreciated, as opposed to just stuck.
Yeah, you're right. His way of speaking, his background is absolutely interesting and makes the movie more interesting. And furthermore, really serves to establish him as the outsider in Wakandan society. He is so much different from everyone else there that you really feel the wrongness of having him just suddenly take over the throne and claim the mantle of kingship.
And of course, I think that this is very well done. You expect with our country in the shape it is today that you're going to get a lot of heavy-handed references to Trump. But I think that Killmonger's dethroning of T'Challa makes you think of that without actually beating you over the head with it. He's an outsider. Suddenly he's in power. He's going to do things that are going to
make Wakanda great again.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to take the country in the way it should have been all along, and probably cause a whole lot of death and destruction. So you get why he's dangerous and the importance of taking them down.
Yeah, and the discussions he has with the tribal elders over wanting Wakanda to project power out into the world, wanting to Wakanda to help oppressed peoples everywhere around the globe. This was one of the moments of the movie that I really did like, because there's something that's seductive and attractive in hearing someone say, we're going to help the oppressed rise up and end their oppression. We're going to use our wealth and our resources to make the world a better place. But as he's talking, I at least am sitting in the theater and thinking of all the ways this can go wrong and turn into an utter bloodbath, because you can't force everybody to do the right thing. No matter how much vibranium and advanced technology you have, no matter how pure your intentions are, and perhaps it's debatable how pure Eric's intentions actually were, but at a certain point, you can't force people to do what's right. Some people just aren't going to want to, and some of the people that you're trying to help aren't going to want your help, and it's going to turn into a bloodbath. And I like the way the movie approached that subject, because I don't think it necessarily beat you over the head with it, but it provided something to think about.
Exactly. That's what makes him a good villain. He perfectly encapsulates, he's a symbol what happens when we don't care for our neighbors, essentially, you know, when we let this violence continue, but his solution is wrong. It's the difference between, you know, invading Afghanistan or Iraq and the CDC sending scientists to Africa to help eradicate Ebola before it comes to America. And that essentially is the lesson that Black Panther takes from it, this idea of peaceful involvement rather than the violence of, you know, neo-imperialism.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we've had a couple of scenes we've kind of skipped over and skipped around. There was the second ritual combat between Killmonger and T'Challa over the kingship, which of course T'Challa loses, gets thrown over the side of the waterfall, which is one of those classic he's not really dead moments, because unless you see the spear go through the heart, you haven't actually died. So you know T'Challa's coming back at some point. But we go through the entire kingship ceremony again with Killmonger. He ingests the heart-shaped flower. He lays down, visits the ancestors, in which we get some nice flashback scenes of him and his father, and a little bit of him trying to perhaps take up his father's mantle and do what his father was trying to do, rather than being pure evil, which, as you say, makes him an interesting, complex, good villain.
Yeah, this is where all that disguised exposition begins to pay off, because now that T'Challa's established everything and you've seen the straight man go through this whole experience, you see someone twisted go through it too, and you know, it provides this new interesting angle. And speaking of interesting angles, it only just occurs to me that even though we knew the basic steps of how T'Challa was going to lose his throne and come back, I think they did a good job of playing a little bit with the execution. You know, usually if a character, you know, quote, dies, end quote, first of all, it's not the main character. You know, the side character, we think he's dead, and then the supporting character saves the day at the end and gives the main character the chance to finish off the bad guy or what have you. In this one, you don't know what's happened to the main character of the movie for a while. And that's a bit different. And when he does pop up, at least for me, it was a genuine surprise. I didn't expect M'Baku to have him.
Yeah, that was a surprise. You expect to see him maybe, you know, being swept downstream and then coming back to consciousness and slowly pulling himself out of the water. And no, we get here he's been so badly injured that the Jabari have found him, and he's essentially being kept alive by using snow to, one assumes, keep a fever down. Otherwise, he would be dead. Either that or we're supposed to think it's some kind of hibernation technique. I'm not quite sure which. But yeah, it was surprising how he survived the fight and how he came back. Now, I will say, and this is, it's not in the Marvel DNA, so I absolutely cannot hold this against the movie, but I was a little bit hoping we would get some kind of a interesting surprise twist, and that the Black Panther at the end of the movie would turn out to not be T'Challa, but to turn out to be either Shuri or Nakia, that one of them would ingest the flower, would take on the mantle of being the Black Panther, and we would get an awesome tale of a female heroine taking over the mantle. I think that would have been such a fun twist. But as I say, not in the Marvel DNA, and was absolutely never going to happen.
I have to agree that I was not sure where that last remaining flower was going to go. And while I wasn't disappointed that it went back to T'Challa to restore him, I did think there was possibility there. Funny you mentioned the Marvel DNA, because Shuri actually does take over the mantle of the Black Panther for a while in the comic books. And I don't think it's completely out of the question in a sequel, at least for, you know, part of a movie or something while T'Challa is out of commission or what have you. Yeah, it didn't seem like a foregone conclusion that T'Challa would get his powers back, much like Captain America for fair lengths of his history has gone without the super serum. You know, he gets a blood transfusion to save him, and then he just has to make do with being a great fighter for a while. I mean, it's not like his superpowers are absolutely intrinsic to the character. You could have given it to Shuri, and then she could have just been stronger than him, and you could have added that interesting aspect to the character.
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen some of the comics, or at least seen references to the comics where Shuri was the Black Panther, and I think that was why I was sitting there in the movie theater kind of almost hoping that she would just decide to grab the mantle for herself. But I'm fine with T'Challa being the Black Panther at the end of the movie. Again, I enjoy Chadwick Boseman in the role. I think he does a great job. So I'm fine with that outcome. I think where I do want to stop and talk here is about these heart-shaped flowers. And I'm going to start with a question. Is this comic book canon that this is how the Black Panther gains his strength and speed?
Yeah, it's not a flower. I think it's an herb. And it's honestly been a long time since I've read a story in which it greatly figures. I think the only one that I can recall now, in fact, is one in which Eric Killmonger successfully beats the tar out of Black Panther and tries to become the new Black Panther, but it turns out that the herb is poisonous to anyone but them of the royal line. Yeah, spoiler alert, sorry.
I'll watch out for that when I get to that particular series.
Yeah, anyway, though, that's basically right.
Okay, so I had Killmonger orders the women to burn all of the flowers. He wants to be the last one to take the power and to be the Black Panther. And we're only saved by, I think it's Nakia that sneaks in and grabs the last flower. I had a problem with this because, one, it seemed short-sighted of Killmonger to utterly destroy that which gives him his strength. You'd think you'd want to keep a reserve for if you ever needed a second dose for whatever reason. But more to the point, that scene got me thinking about super strength and super speed in the Black Panther suit in general. And I started wondering about what exactly was going on when T'Chaka was king, the Captain America Civil War time frame. T'Chaka's king, and we've seen in the 80s, is wearing the Black Panther suit. And then after he dies, we see T'Challa putting on the suit and chasing after Captain America and Bucky Barnes, looking like he has super strength and super speed, which just got me wondering, do they have two Black Panthers powered up, even though the second one isn't exactly the king? Because the whole ceremony looks like you ingest the flower as part of the kingship. But it does appear that he's been using the benefits of the super speed and super strength, even as just Crown Prince of Wakanda.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't think too hard about it, not because there isn't a reasonable solution, but just because I can think of several reasonable solutions and none of them are that important. You know, maybe they went through the whole thing again after the whole after the events of Captain America Civil War, but just to get him out in the field, they gave him the flower real quick. Maybe T'Chaka kind of aged out of the role, or he's just a really strong older man, and T'Challa has actually been doing the field work for him for a while. I don't know. This is the sort of thing that you fixate on a little more than me because you're more technical, I think.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. It's just one of those things that once you put it into the movie, me and I suppose people like me start to think through the details and then start to come up with all kinds of questions that the movie hasn't answered and isn't really interested in answering. And it's not really a problem. but I appreciate movies that don't start me down that path of wondering about all of the technical details, because I really try hard not to. I know I have my own tendency of ruining movies, so I try not to, and I felt like this movie just kind of reached out and smacked me with it, and then I had to think about it.
Well, often those left-out details are great fodder for additional stories, sometimes that mystery is even a good thing.
It's certainly going to have me reading more of the comics, trying to figure out if there's an answer to whether or not there is generally two powered-up individuals or not. So I suppose it has that going for it.
Okay, so I'm a little lost now. Where are we in the story?
We've been circling all around. I guess the main event we haven't yet gotten to is Killmonger as king is wanting to arm all of Wakanda's undercover agents around the world and start some kind of global mass insurrection. At which point we've got T'Challa also coming back and trying to wrest the control of the kingdom back before everything is irreversibly changed.
Right. Getting into the Trump parallels again real quick, I thought Okoye's decision to remain in charge of the Dora Milaje was a really good character moment for her, and her difference with Nakia, how once Okoye saw it as her duty to serve the government no matter what, and Nakia saw herself as serving the nation no matter what.
Yeah, I very much like that part of the movie as well. And again, that felt very true to Okoye's character, that she is the leader of the Dora Milaje. She is sworn to the throne rather than to a specific individual. And if you can't keep to the rules, even when you don't like them, then what's the point of even having rules in the first place? So I very much liked her decision and the struggle that she obviously went through. It wasn't an easy decision for her, but it was one that she did feel was right.
If you want to talk quickly about undeveloped characters, though, or rather undeveloped relationships, did you happen to forget that Okoye and Wakabi were a couple? Because honestly, I think I did.
Yeah, I forgot about it all the way up until the moment that it really, really mattered at the end of the movie, and then it suddenly came back to me. But yes, that was something that seemed backburner during most of the movie.
Yeah, if there was going to be a little more punch to that, they needed to drive it home a little bit more. It was just sort of name-checked more than anything, or just kind of checkmarked. That said, one of the great shots of the movie, again, of the ones that were there was Wakabi kind of ceding to Okoye.
Yes. So I don't know how much of the details we want to talk through at this point, because I don't want this conversation to go on forever and ever, and I think we could do that if we wanted to. So I don't know how much of the rest of the movie we want to skip over or discuss in depth.
Well, you got to mention the rhinos.
Well, you got to mention the rhinos. And that was kind of my thought. Do we talk about some of the bigger philosophical power aspects, or do we just jump straight to the battle? Because that was kind of awesome.
Yes, it was. It put me in mind of The Lord of the Rings, actually, was how excited I felt by it. I thought that it was great. I understood what everyone on the field could do, if you would. Everything was well established. I understood what was going on. The rhinos were a really fun surprise in that, you know, they're established and they just seemed like part of the scenery, like so much that this movie does. It plays that trick on you. It makes you think it's just kind of showing you something cool or unimportant. And then later, war rhinos!
Yeah, the war rhinos. And I love that it was set up with the simple conversation between T'Challa and Wakabi earlier in the movie. They're just hanging out, they're talking, and there's a rhino because it's Africa and why not? And then they come riding into battle on rhinos, which is just awesome. And it tied in with the general aspect that I loved of constantly having the Wakandans look simpler and more primitive than they actually are, that all of these tribesmen are going into battle with what looks like spears and what looks like tribal capes that they're wearing. And then all of a sudden these tribal capes flip around and are vibranium force shields, which is just awesome.
Absolutely. It's all again, aesthetically different and recognizably African, but feels fresh for that. I don't have so many notes about the battle itself. I really don't. But I will say that despite the foregone conclusion of it all, I was pretty entertained throughout.
Yeah, the battle was one of the few fight sequences that I didn't feel like I knew how it was going to go. I knew what the ultimate outcome was going to be. Probably, although you can never be quite sure what Marvel's going to set up for the next movie in their series. But I was pretty sure I knew what the outcome was going to be. But the way we got there was interesting and different, and that made that scene very entertaining.
Okay, come to think of it, I do have one note, which is the death in that battle. Did Eric Killmonger kill anyone important, or did they really just kill a random member of the Dora Milaje because they couldn't bear to kill any of their supporting cast?
Yeah, none of the main supporting cast died in that battle. Everybody notable came through it alive, as far as I can remember.
It's kind of a bizarre moment. It's treated as you know, the beat that you would expect in this kind of movie, where Eric ups the stakes by killing someone important, but instead he just grabs one of the guards.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that until now, but now that you mention it, it does stand out a little bit in that it was a relatively clean battle and a relatively clean counter coup. You expected to see somebody important die, but no one actually did.
There was probably another way to do that that would have made the Dora Milaje's sacrifice meaningful, but as it stood, it just seemed like they'd accidentally subbed out a nobody in a scene that was otherwise unchanged.
I think we could call this the reverse Joss Whedon.
Well, you know, he's well established enough at this point to where he's his own set of tropes, so I think that's legit.
Yeah, yeah. Fight sequence between Killmonger and T'Challa. I don't know. I don't really have much thoughts about this. The fall through the vibranium mine, very CGI, very meh. The fight on the train, not really tracks because it's a maglev train, but the fight on the train track, it was what it was. It was fine. I didn't think it was one of the high points of the movie.
I didn't. I don't remember anyway, which is pretty much the same problem. I don't remember why it was important for them to lose their... Oh, that's right. Okay, no. Now I remember the suits are depowered by the vibranium, and that's how Black Panther can get him. That made sense to me just fine, because it is kind of a special power to be able to absorb kinetic energy. I will disagree about the fall through the mine, though. I thought that was one of those previously mentioned, treasured, beautiful shots, how the royal markings on the suits became what was highlighted as they fell through that glittering mine.
Visually, yeah, if you were to freeze it and take a freeze frame as a single image, it was nice looking, but as part of a fight sequence, I didn't like it. Too much of a zero-G space combat kind of thing going on, and just... Like I say, it wasn't bad. It just, yeah, it was the one part of the fight that I thought was less good than anything else.
Okay, fair enough. Let's see. We've already discussed sort of the role that T'Challa, or the moral that T'Challa takes away from the story after he's all done. He gets to kiss Nakia, yay. And then we get to his decision to open up these nonprofits, or rather this, super border, man, I've just completely lost it here.
Cultural exchange centers.
No, what's the word? Foreign aid program. That's what I'm trying to say.
There you go.
Exactly. Which all leads to this mid-credit scene, which was kind of if you want to talk about disappointments, I thought the mid-credit scene kind of qualified. In fact, both the in-credit scenes were kind of like, to me.
Yeah, there's no reason why the mid-credit scene couldn't have just been the end of the movie. And so from that aspect as a mid-credit scene, it kind of failed, because the mid-credit scenes are supposed to be some kind of bonus. And this to me just felt like the logical conclusion to the movie.
Exactly. And it also was oddly followed the same beat as the end of the movie, because the movie ends with someone asking, the kid asking, "Who are you?" And Black Panther gives a look right before he answers and then cut. But then in the mid-credit scene, essentially the same exact thing happens, that he gets asked by this very unreasonably and unlikely rude diplomat, what Wakanda can possibly do. And once again, you get that look from Black Panther and then the cut of the scene.
Right. Yeah, it was either superfluous or it was in the wrong place. Either way, it didn't really work. I do find it interesting that it resolved the question from earlier in the movie regarding whether Wakanda should accept refugees and open up, or whether Wakanda should reach outside of its borders to help people that needed help. And given that that's been such a potent political question here in America, I do find it a little bit interesting that the movie rather quietly resolved it as, no, we're going to go out into the world and we're going to take our wealth and our expertise and our knowledge and we're going to go out and share it rather than inviting the rest of the world in.
That's interesting, but I think you're probably just quibbling with, I think you're probably reading too much into it. I feel like that's detail, and the moral is to be engaged with the world rather than to just kind of hoard all your resources for yourself by keeping people at arm's length.
Yeah, I don't want to overstate my thoughts. Engagement is engagement, and you want to be engaged. I do think it's a little bit of an interesting question whether it's best to, or maybe not even best, whether it's more effective to open your doors and say, everybody come on in now, or whether it's to go out to where people are and try to help. And to me, I liked that they went out to where people were and helped. I feel like in the long run, that's going to be more effective, to be in Oakland, to be in Nigeria, to be in Nairobi, to be in Kenya or Egypt. Wherever people are needing help, there, not everybody's going to be able to get to you, but you can go to them and can help.
Concerning the other scene, the post-credit scene, that also disappointed me. Honestly, I did not watch Civil War again prior to this, so I had completely forgotten that Bucky Barnes was in Wakanda. But now that I have been reminded, it didn't really play into the movie at all, so it's really just a tease for him doing something in yet another movie. So whatever it is that Bucky Barnes is going to be doing in the future, it better be good, because you've, you know, teased me about it twice.
Yeah, obviously he's going to be involved in Infinity War in some way, shape, or form, presumably coming out of Wakanda, but as a setup for Infinity War, this felt rather weak.
Yeah, and after Ryan Coogler said that it was an important part of the setup to Infinity War and what have you, which I guess it would have to be Bucky Barnes. Conceivably, he could take over as Captain America, and Steve Rogers could die in the Infinity War. That might justify the build-up.
There would be a twist. It very well could be a very important setup for Infinity War. It's just that I'm going to have to wait to Infinity War to find out why it is that this setup was important, which seems a little bit backwards for a setup.
Yeah. well said. And, okay, that's the whole movie, and also the end of this experiment in which, unlike with previous movie reviews, we try going through the plot blow by blow and sort of annotating things as opposed to just discussing the various traits of the movie one after the other.
And I think that actually worked for this discussion, since I still am not quite sure what I feel about the movie. I feel like I like it. It's a perfectly fine movie. Like Iron Man 3, I'll watch it if I happen to come across it. I just think for me it falls into the broad middle of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. As I keep thinking back over it, it had a lot of good individual scenes that I liked, had a lot of moments that I liked, but overall it just feels a little flat to me.
I was going to ask if going through the movie's plot had resolved for you the question of why you didn't love it, and you're saying...
I'm saying, yeah, I guess I don't love it because it wasn't one of those Marvel movies that really grabbed me and made me pay attention and made me love it. Which I guess I would say is the case for a number of the recent Marvel movies. Captain America Civil War itself, aside from the giant airport fight sequence, which was cool, the rest of the movie is fine. But then again, there's other movies that I liked better, such as Doctor Strange, that just felt like it had more to stand out about it for whatever reason. So I think that's my final verdict on the movie. Thumbs up. If you're wondering if you should go see it, the answer is yes, you should. It's a good movie. Do I think it's going to be the highlight of my Marvel collection? Eh, probably not.
Yeah, fair enough. I've been trying to place it in my mind and decide for and take note of whenever I come across something that really stands out for me regarding the movie, and I think I've said my piece that I'm not in love with the characters, even though, you know, I do feel affection for a few of them. Okoye, I forgot how much I liked her before we started having this conversation. Killmonger will go down as one of the best villains of the Marvel Universe so far. And beyond being thematically smart, it took me somewhere I had not been yet. So I would say that combination of being really well written and having taken me somewhere new is why I place this movie in the upper tier of the middle list or the low high tier of the Marvel Universe list, depending on where the boundary lies.
I think we're almost in agreement with maybe just a little bit of a different emphasis, in that it sounds like we both would kind of put it somewhere near the middle. Maybe you'd put it a little bit more high middle than I would. But at the same time, it's certainly no Thor 2. It stands high above multiple other Marvel movies. And I think it's notable that this is a movie that's doing as well financially and with critics as it is, given that it is an all-minority cast. And one thing I've really been wanting Marvel to do is do more of the female superheroines, whether it's Captain Marvel or whether it's Black Widow. And I'm encouraged by the fact that a movie that's largely targeted at minorities is doing this well. It gives me hope that Marvel will have the courage to maybe greenlight that Black Widow movie that we've all been wanting.
Yeah, I'd still watch it, even if that movie Red Sparrow is about to eat Marvel's lunch with regard to the Black Widow. You know, it's essentially an R-rated kick-butt version of the Black Widow story. Totally.
So I think that's where we end up. I don't feel like I really have much else to say other than how glad I am that it is not Thor 2, because man, was that movie bad. But that's another podcast for another night.
Absolutely. I think it's, I guess I'll close by saying, I was reading and I did not realize this. You know, I'm strut with my comics lore, but I was not aware that Black Panther was the first black superhero. And so, it's appropriate and cool that he's the one to break this major barrier and, lead the way in superhero movies with this kind of representation and blockbusters.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well @AdamVolley. That's Adam, VOLLE.